Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Arthur Haynes, a botanist, forager, and wild food expert from Maine, where he teaches this information through his school, the Delta Institute. You can find out more about Arthur at arthurhaynes.com, for which you'll find a link in the show notes. Arthur is a returning guest, so if you'd like to learn more about him and foraging, please check out the first interview. I like Arthur and the work he's doing and how he shares this information. He's steeped in not only the history and lore of wild plants, native foods, and foraging, but also is able to provide plenty of examples to go along with the conversation. To carry this discussion, we begin with a definition of what Arthur means by a wild food, and then discuss four main areas where wild foods generally differ from their cultivated cousins. Those areas are nutrient density, phytochemistry, essential fatty acid ratio, and calories relative to fiber. There's a lot of useful information in this conversation. I just wish that our connection that day had been a bit better. You'll hear that when you give it a listen, but please stick with us through it, as what we cover is well worth your time, ties several previous interviews together nicely, and sets us up for an interview I recently recorded with Dr. John Kitsteiner about permaculture, food, and our health. To round out this show, I'm also including links to some past conversations about foraging, tending the wild, and nutrient density. In listening to those, you'll get to hear the first conversation with Arthur, as well as those with Sam Thayer, Ben Wise, Wilson Alvarez, Dan Kittredge, and Mary Johnson. If you enjoy this discussion and the others related to it, please consider making a donation to the show so I can keep things going. Find out how at thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. Now then, on to Arthur Haynes. I'll join you afterwards with some thoughts and updates. Well then, Arthur, thank you for joining me today to take this conversation about wild foods that we first touched on in our first interview together a little bit further. Because we have spoken together before, I don't want to review your background and biography, as I might normally do in starting an interview. If listeners would like, I recommend that they go back and listen to that first conversation we had together in order to have an idea of who you are, your background with foraging and wild foods. But in order to keep us kind of on track with this more focused discussion, could you give us a little bit of an understanding of exactly what wild foods are, how you would define them, and we can take the conversation from there?
Sure thing, Scott. Of course, one of the first things that we need to recognize is that there isn't a clear-cut distinction between wild foods and cultivated foods, but there's more of a scale. In other words, there are those foods that people have never cultivated and are able to grow in the wild and propagate themselves on their own. And then there are those species that are completely seedless and 100% now dependent on humans for their continued propagation. But we also have lots of types of plants in the middle of those two extremes. Perhaps wild species that have not been heavily selected for traits that are occasionally grown near people's homes or transplanted so that they can better take advantage of these species. Or for that matter, even wild plants that aren't grown or transplanted but are perhaps weeded around, or other forms of management, if you will, that allow people to better take advantage of these resources. So with that kind of recognition that there is no black and white wild versus cultivated plant, going forward from that, I would simply say in sort of a general summary that wild plants are those species that we find growing on our landscape that we did not intentionally plant and we do not necessarily actively aid in their propagation. Now, that also means that there are some species that we cultivated that can escape that cultivated setting and grow in a wild setting without people's assistance. And there are many examples of this. For example, the parsnip is a species that we find wild in our fields and along roadsides here in the Northeast that, though cultivated, now acts like a wild plant in places where the canopy has been cleared. So hopefully that will help sort of summarize what I'm talking about when I speak about a wild plant during this interview.
And I want to take that thought a little bit just so that I can
personally clarify my own thinking about this. So if I were weeding around some brambles that I found that are just on my property and I don't know when they were necessarily planted because I didn't take care of them, but they've just been naturally kind of propagating themselves for years, that could be one of those wild or semi-wild foods. Or like finding someone's overgrown yard that once had an apple tree that was taken care of, but now it's kind of turned into its own natural orchard. Those trees that grew from the original parent plant that have now kind of removed themselves from human cultivation fall into that like a semi-wild food then also?
Yeah, I would completely agree with that, Scott. And although it would be important to recognize in the case of apples, let's say, they have had their genetics altered somewhat through breeding to create that large, crisp fruit that we associate with apples. Of course, its wild progenitor produced something that was much smaller, not nearly as sweet, without quite as much sugar content. But just the same, when those plants leave the cultivated setting and return to a more wild setting, they need to now take care of themselves. They don't have people removing pests from them. They don't have people dealing with competitors, other plants, pathogenic fungi that might try to attack those plants. And so these species need to essentially ramp up their defenses, because they don't have humans doing that role for them anymore. And simply just in that context of needing to fend for themselves, we find that plants become more nutritious for us. And I'm using nutrition in a very, very broad sense here to also include those beneficial phytochemicals that we get from plants that we can talk more about later. So recognizing that some of the plants that I would consider to be wild have not had their genome intentionally modified through breeding or laboratory techniques is one part of them, as well as some wild plants have had some genetic manipulation of some form, but yet they are still now able to grow wild and propagate themselves without human intervention.
Your use of language there about genetic modification. So I don't mean this in like a GMO sense where we're doing modification in the lab, but is it fair to say that plant breeding represents a form of genetic modification?
Yeah, and that's the exact sense that I'm using it in, Scott. What most people don't realize is, let's say when we walk into the supermarket and we start looking at the selection of plants being offered to us there, with the exception of some certain seasonal species that are still wild collected, for example, here in the Northeast, the ostrich fern fiddlehead is something that will show up in the supermarket in May of the year. That is a completely wild species of plant that is not intentionally cultivated. With the exception of those types of foods, every plant in there, essentially, has been genetically modified through breeding. Now, we don't like to necessarily think of breeding as genetic modification because we have a real stigma around that word, because we understand that it represents some changes that are not always helpful to the plant, the environment, and to our health. But in fact, that's exactly what happens. If you were to look at any of the species that you purchase, for example, corn, if you looked at the wild progenitor of corn, it's a tiny plant, and I'm talking about its fruit now, not actually the stature of the whole plant, but its fruit is about the size of your finger with only a few kernels enclosed in a hard, bony shell. And this was something that the indigenous of the area would grind with stone tools and essentially turn it into a powder that they would mix with water to form a drink. And to get to the form of corn that we have today required a lot of genetic modification. And it was simply done through breeding over many, many, many generations. And we can use this way of describing plants over and over and over again. For example, if you were to look at the wild progenitor of lettuce, it looks nothing like the lettuce that we see today in the store. In fact, it has spines on the underside of the leaves and tastes quite bitter compared to a lot of the milder forms of lettuce that we see in the store. One more example, if you were to look at the wild progenitor of eggplant, it's a tiny spherical fruit that's armed with prickles on the complete exterior of this fruit. And the fruit is very, very small. It would easily fit in the palm of your hand, not like the modern eggplant that we see today. So to get from these wild forms to the forms that we see in the supermarket today have involved genetic modification. The genomes are different between the wild progenitors, those wild species that gave rise to the cultivated forms that we see today.
I don't want to take us too far away from the conversation of wild foods with this question about genetic modification, because we're talking about breeding. And then when the discussion turns to GMOs, as we think of what we would hear in the news and what the plant scientists are doing with companies such as Monsanto to introduce genetic material into the genome for plants as a form of genetic modification. One of the pieces that I understand of how human beings have modified plants' genetics is through mutagenic means, by exposing them to chemicals or radiation that essentially causes the plant to mutate and then plant those seeds and select for the mutations that we prefer. Are you familiar with that idea at all, or could you speak to it?
I can't speak much to it, Scott. I'm aware that I remember seeing this in my genetics classes that I had while I was at the University of Maine. But those types of techniques that are used, including these laboratory methods where we're taking the genome, not just of another plant, but sometimes of a completely different organism that belongs to a different kingdom of life, into the genome of the plants that we now eat. Many of these things I simply stay away from. In other words, they're not the foods that I'm willing to bring into this home and put into our body. So I have an awareness of the method, but I don't want to pretend that I can speak to them in detail because I simply avoid them like the plague.
Well, you have your expertise and area of focus, and I thank you for the honesty of that answer. Well, let us then move away from this question of genetic modification now that we've at least touched on the idea of what it is and what it represents in the myriad of forms that are available to human beings, both historically and in the modern scientific sense, and turn back to wild foods. So why do you have this interest in wild foods and wild nutrition?
There's a few different reasons that I have such an interest in these foods and wild food. And bringing up that genetic modification topic is one of the reasons that I'm so interested in the wild food. Because once we understand that the produce that we have in the store has all been modified from its wild progenitor, there have been changes. And it isn't just changes in physical form and color, but there have been other significant changes that occur to the food that we buy in the supermarket. And there are four of them, which I may have noted in the last podcast, that serve as a really nice springboard for us to go into a lot more detail in the differences between wild and cultivated plants. And so, first and foremost, and this is always on average, there are exceptions to everything that I'm going to present, but generally speaking, these patterns hold out. There have been losses in nutrition from the wild to the cultivated form. In other words, the wild species tend to be more nutrient-dense, particularly in the arena of vitamins, and often that's also true of minerals. The wild species are a much richer source of phytochemistry. In other words, all of the compounds that plants make for the various things that they need to accomplish, which also includes defense of their organism against pathogens, against herbivores, and other things that would seek to cause harm to them. On average, the wild foods have a better balanced ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acids. So these are essential fatty acids. These are polyunsaturated fatty acids. In other words, these would be liquid at room temperature if we were to extract them and sit them in a container on the counter of our home. And we can't produce either of these fatty acids, which means both of them are very essential and very beneficial to us. However, in our modern diet, because we tend to be a grain-based society, including meaning that the animal foods that we eat tend to be fed a high proportion of grain, which might be in direct contrast to what they should be fed in terms of the biologically appropriate diet, the foods that we consume tend to be skewed toward the omega-6 fatty acid ratio, which ends up contributing to inflammation and suppressing our immune system. And wild foods balance this out by lowering the omega-6 and raising the omega-3 in a relative sense to create a more balanced food, which is what we had in our original, our historical diet. And last, and this one is very easy for people to see if they're familiar with wild versus cultivated types of food, the cultivated plants now provide far more calories relative to the amount of fiber that they have. And that makes sense. We love these sweet, juicy fruits, but very often, and this again, not always, but very often, the wild species were not anywhere near as juicy, were filled with seeds, and though edible, they simply didn't provide the same amount of calories per unit mass as do wild species. So these four differences, nutrient density, phytochemistry, an essential fatty acid ratio, and an amount of calories, which we can also think of as an amount of fiber that the foods produce, has all changed in the last 10 to 12,000 years.
With the order that you gave these to us, I'd actually kind of like to walk backwards through them and start with that last comment that you made about calories versus fiber.
Mm-hmm.
Then we can kind of end on that bigger note about nutrition, which I, at least in my thinking, is kind of the bigger piece of all of this. But when you talked about these wild plants being usually smaller, having less calories versus the amount of fiber in them, one of the plants that's becoming cultivated here in Pennsylvania, I don't know if it is further up in the Northeast where you are pawpaws.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, a lot of the things that I'm finding are just someone who happened to eat the fruit from a particular tree and they said, this tastes good. And then that's what they're starting to slowly propagate from. But they're probably the closest thing that I'm buying at my farmer's market to a wild food that I can think of. And those are ones, when I get them, I'm picking out these seeds that are the size of the first joint of my thumb. And there's six or eight of them in a fruit that will just fit in my hand. They're not very large fruits. They kind of take a lot of work to get at, though very, very tasty. The flesh inside is still a little kind of stringy and a little strange. It doesn't have that smooth, seedless consistency like a banana would.
Right. We've gotten used to a very different consistency, a very different flavor, just a whole different even size of a fruit, where instead of needing to do a lot of work to gather a certain amount of calories, we sort of took care of that in the background through selection, through hybridization, and through other breeding techniques, so that that work was completed for us essentially by the time we got to the supermarket. So now when we go in and we consume, say, a banana, well, it's completely seedless, and it has this creamy, wonderful, sweet texture that we've all come to love. And we're told that bananas are a health food, and they're loaded with certain minerals like potassium. And this is all true. I'm not trying to state that bananas have no benefit for us to consume. But again, if we look at its wild progenitor, it is just like the pawpaw that you're describing. It is a seeded fruit. And the seeds have a small layer of flesh around them that is edible, completely different to the bananas that we essentially clone today to propagate so that we can have them for food. And so it is a lot more work in terms of getting the amount of calories that we're used to getting from the farmed produce.
With your comment about not wanting to disparage bananas, if you will, you're not looking to eliminate the supermarket from our diet, but to have a more balanced blend between what we are farming as a large portion of our calories to something that's a little bit more balanced between these more healthful, nutritious wild foods and what we can buy readily at the supermarket or farmer's market?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Scott. I mean, the reality is with this many people on the planet, we can't become hunter-gatherers again. Not all of us. Individual families can do it, small communities can do it, but cities can't. And we recognize that. That's just a fundamental obstacle that we've now run into by having over 7 billion people on this planet. So That is not to say that people shouldn't go to the store and buy food, plant foods from those stores anymore. But what I do when I go to the store is I look for the least modified fruits that we eat. In other words, I can't tell you the last time I bought a seedless watermelon. I don't think I have for years and years and years, because it represents a massive modification from its wild progenitor. I tend to favor buying those fruits that most resemble their wild progenitors. And great examples of this would be things like blueberries and raspberries, blackberries, currants, and those kind of species where there isn't anybody that would have any trouble recognizing the wild progenitor of these now modern cultivated foods, because the level of modification that they have experienced is much less. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. In mentioning fruits, what about our produce in the supermarket? What are some things there that are least modified?
Well, let's take lettuce, for example. And this is going to be, I think, a no-brainer for most people. We recognize and we can look at the nutritional statistics of, say, iceberg lettuce, and recognize that this form of lettuce is pretty much devoid of its nutrition. It's devoid of its phytochemistry. In other words, those beneficial plant compounds that do all kinds of wonderful things inside our body that I'll wait until we get to that part of the talk to discuss in more detail. And understand that this represents a most derived species of wild lettuce. But we can back up towards species that more closely mimic the actual wild progenitor of lettuce, or we can just eat the wild progenitor. But aside from going that route of foraging, we would look for things like leaf lettuces in the supermarket. And we can very quickly identify these foods as being more potent and more like the wild progenitor, because they often have a stronger, and when I say stronger, I don't necessarily mean that in a poor sense, but they have stronger flavors than, say, the iceberg lettuce, which has a very mild flavor. I mean, leafy greens and shoots that are coming up through the season would simply be consumed by insect herbivores and mammalian herbivores if they didn't have some manner of protecting themselves. And they do that through various bitter-tasting compounds that are types of terpenes and sometimes alkaloids, depending on the plant that we're talking about, to essentially ward off these things that want to eat them. Well, it turns out that those bitter flavors, in this case, actually serve a great role in our body in maintaining health. Another example are things like mustard greens, and there's a number of species that we could talk about, including arugula, that obviously have a stronger, a more mustard or horseradish spicy taste to them. Well, it turns out that these are greens that more accurately resemble their wild progenitor. So as a result, they tend to have greater nutrition than the milder flavored species. Now, again, that is not always borne out that you can just identify the plant's nutrition through its flavor profile. But generally speaking, if you have a number of different types of a fruit or a green or a shoot, those that are smaller and stronger tasting and more seeded will generally be closer to the wild progenitor in terms of its nutrition, its phytochemistry, its fiber, and its essential fatty acid profile.
Does color play much of a role in selecting that? I think about being told to seek out those like dark leafy vegetables or some of the like dark red lettuces and things like that.
I think color is an indication of that variety that we get in our diet, because those colors are created by different plant pigments and indicate essentially a different plant compounds that we would be incorporating into our diet. But when I'm out on the landscape foraging, I see a wide range of greens when I'm gathering wild leaves and stalks that I'm going to be consuming for food. Many of them are pale green, some are reddish green, others are just a mid-tone green, others, like you mentioned, are a very dark green. And even some of these species that do not have particularly dark green leaves are still highly nutritious foods, the few that have been analyzed, that is. We don't have, you know, tons and tons of information on the nutrient content of wild plants, but those that we do have information on are quite stellar in the world of plant nutrition when we're comparing them against their cultivated counterparts. So although I think it's good to not necessarily just focus on dark green, but all kinds of colors of green, if that makes any sense.
It does. I'm thinking about my young children, and they're being taught to have a rainbow on their plate is now the way that they're discussing how to eat. And I remember when I was a kid, it was, you know, the food pyramid, which didn't really give a lot of indication for how to eat, but just how many servings of what to eat.
Yes.
And your mention about the balance between the omega-6 and the omega-3 fatty acids. I know that my doctor has recommended, really to my entire family, that we take some kind of an omega-3 supplement because that's something that our diet is generally lacking. And from some reading that I've done about grass-fed beef and more, if you will, naturally raised animals for meat, that they have a different profile of fats versus our feedlot animals.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Scott. If you look at what was assumed to be the intake of omega-6 and omega-3 fatty acids by hunter-gatherer populations, in other words, those people that we hail from, and we have to remember that not only Homo sapiens, the anatomically modern human, but also the archaic human, like Homo heidelbergensis and species like that. But even from before that, our hominid ancestor, Homo erectus, and before that, Homo habilis, all of these species have been consuming a wild diet their entire lives, right? There were no cultivated foods that have been modified by humans, not heavily modified as in what we see now in our food stores. And when we look at the indigenous who lived on this planet, estimates of their ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acids was approximately 2-to-1. Now, we know that some had a 1-to-1 ratio and some had as high as a 4-to-1 ratio, but generally speaking, the average was about 2-to-1. But if we look at the standard American diet, which is incredibly rich in grains, and many seed-like fruits, nuts, legumes especially with soy being used for so much of our food now, our ratios are generally speaking in the better end about 8-to-1. Most Americans are somewhere in the 10-to-1 to 20-to-1 category. And so that's a phenomenal shift in the types of lipids that we are consuming. And it's not just the fact that we're eating a lot more grains in our diet. You think about it, almost everything revolves around grains. Like, there's hardly a lunch that's made now that doesn't involve grains in some way because people are eating pasta and rice and sandwiches and all of the types of breads that are made today are mostly grains or things that have similar nutrition profiles. On top of that, we're feeding all our animals grains, and that affects the lipid that we take in from those foods as well. And for example, one of the best and clear-cut examples of this are eggs. If you look at a chicken who is raised on grain, and only grain, and this can even be an organic grain, that's irrelevant whether it's conventionally or organically raised grain in terms of its lipid profile, that egg will have a ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acids of 19-to-1. That means that egg is a really inflammatory and immune-suppressing food. Although it has a lot of other benefits, too, it is not the superfood that an egg should be. And if we look at a chicken, and I don't mean one that is just free-range inside of a small cage in an area and walking in dirt, but one that actually has access to pasture, one that can be eating green grass, green plants, and also consuming insects that are found on those green plants, we find that those eggs have a ratio closer to 1-to-1. So there's a massive difference between these two types of eggs, and it means that paying for those pastured eggs is very much worth it, even though they're more expensive, right? It's really worth it because we're taking in such a phenomenally different nutrition from these two types of foods. And we see the same thing there out with beef. Grain-fed beef has been tested at somewhere in the realm of 5-to-1, whereas grass-fed beef is in the realm of 2-to-1 in terms of omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acids. And we need to remember that an excess of omega-6 fatty acids leads to a sheet of chronic degenerative problems. And in fact, what the really amazing thing right now is that emerging evidence is showing that, in fact, though diabetics have a problem managing sugar intake in their diet, the problem may actually be created by too many fatty acids that are being consumed in the diet. And again, I'm talking about the polyunsaturated fatty acids, those fats that would be liquid at room temperature.
Looking over my notes here and thinking about this, I actually feel fortunate in the American system that I have a doctor who is very proactive about health and living a healthy lifestyle in order to try to prevent many of these degenerative issues so that, if you will, I can stay ahead of age and the American lifestyle.
Yes.
But even then, it's looking at, well, how can we supplement this or supplement that? The idea of eating healthy and eating well. And I look over this and I think about my own family's history with diabetes and blood sugar issues, and yet all the things that are being recommended to help prevent that in my own life is about eating foods that are higher in fiber, eating in a way that is cleaner with less processing. And here's a step where we can do that by making sure that we're eating better eggs and making better choices in the grocery store, as opposed to all this processing, sugar added, grain added, dietary issues.
I mean, I really look at my world in terms of the products that we use through this lens of long indigenous and or traditional use. In other words, if we look at a food that has been consumed by people for, well, maybe, you know, tens of thousands of years or longer, in some cases, or types of foods that have been consumed by indigenous people, by paleo people, it gives us a way to sort of at least anecdotally assess its effects on us and those long-term health effects. In other words, do we know people that consumed this food through their entire lives for generations, and they were still able to have happy, productive lives, and most importantly, produce happy and well-formed and healthy children? That's a part of nutrition that we often don't think about, is that we tend to focus on us, the individual, and think of it in a very egotistical sense. I'm losing weight. I'm feeling healthy. This diet is awesome. But we don't necessarily think about what its effects are on the next generation. And so if we know that this is a food or a type of food that has been consumed by these people for a very long time, and they could still produce healthy children, well, that suggests to us that this is a food that we should have in our diet in some form or another. But what we are running into today, which is what you were just touching on, is when we go to the supermarket, there are all kinds of untested foods that are found there. We haven't eaten them for generations, and we really don't know what their long-term effects are on human health. Or in some cases, we clearly know that they're detrimental to human health, but we continue to eat them anyway, simply because of a convenience issue, or we haven't structured our life in a way to give us time to go to farmers markets, or better yet, to actually spend time learning and foraging those unmodified plant foods off our landscape.
The modern system of the supermarket provides us kind of just a buffet for all of our more, if you will, basic needs of fats and carbohydrates, these macronutrients.
Yeah, these things that are essentially have been wired into us from an evolutionary perspective. I mean, we seek out lipid in our environment because they're such a rich source of energy. And in fact, we need them. Our brain is made of fat in large proportion. Fat and cholesterol, we need these foods. Every one of our cell membranes requires cholesterol to be rigid enough to fulfill its functions. We obviously seek out sweets because, well, sweets were relatively limiting on the landscape. It's not that indigenous people didn't have access to them. I mean, in my part of the world, they had access to maple syrup. And actually, I say maple syrup. That's actually not the form that they usually process it in because they didn't have ball jars to can it in. So they would take it all the way down to maple sugar into a staple form that they could store in their environment. But the point I'm trying to make is these things were not something that they could simply have every day of the year, all through the year, at any amount they want, so long as they have the money to buy it. And so we are wired from a evolutionary perspective to seek these foods out whenever we can find them. And unfortunately, we just have access to not only too many of them, but really refined and very different forms of them today that trick our body into thinking we're getting those wild things that we wanted when in fact we're not.
I definitely want to dig into that idea of nutrition some more. But before we get there, can you speak some more about the phytochemicals that are in plants?
Yeah. One of my favorite examples that I like to use are grapes. And many of my students have heard this example, but we remember that this example would apply to a lot of species. Today, we primarily have seedless grapes that we find in the supermarket. And they're just more fun to eat, for lack of a better word, because we don't have to crunch through these kind of, to describe them, the flavor is of grape seeds is not anything like the flesh itself. It's not sweet and juicy. There's a slight off flavor to them. And so we just bred them out. And now we don't have to deal with the seeds anymore, and we have this super enjoyable food. What we find, though, is that many people lack sweets of polyphenols, these water-soluble plant compounds in their diet, because we've lost these in modern produce. And so we run into all kinds of problems that polyphenols help us protect against, like inflammation, like weak blood vessels, so that that blood flow isn't continually shunted forward as it's supposed to, but it can back up and pool and create varicose veins, for example. So people who are a little bit more natural health oriented would now go to the natural food store and purchase grape seed extract to help strengthen their blood vessels to counteract varicose veins. Well, you probably see where I'm going with this. You could have simply eaten grapes with seeds in them and never had to deal with this problem at all. So we bred the medicine out of the grapes, and then there's a recognition that we need this medicine, so we go buy it in a purified form, so to speak. And it just would have been easier to eat the wild species because we would have been given large doses of medicine. Let me give you a couple more quick examples. If I were to talk about the wild progenitor of lettuce, Lactuca cereola, which is a European species, it's a plant that I can tell you is rich in pro-vitamin A, in other words, in carotenoids, contains large amounts of vitamin C, and even contains vitamin E and vitamin D2, the sort of not quite as biologically active form of vitamin that we normally would use in our body for vitamin D. And it goes on to have a list of plant compounds that we could talk about as well that suppress inflammation, dull pain, and even act as nervines to essentially nourish our central nervous system so that we can sleep more soundly at night. Now, that's what the wild progenitor has. But if we were to talk about the modern cultivated form of lettuce that we find in the supermarket, no one would think of it as a powerhouse of nutrition, and no one would certainly think of it as a powerhouse of medicine, which the wild progenitor is. And the last example, just to show you how far this topic goes, let's take a wild blackberry and a cultivated blackberry. Now, we know that they're really similar in form, right? The wild blackberry may be a little smaller, have slightly larger seeds per unit of the flesh. It may come a little crunchier, but most people would still generally consider the wild blackberry to be something very enjoyable to eat. But the cultivated blackberry is yet a little more juicy and a little more sweet. What we don't realize is that there have been nutritional, from a broad perspective of thinking of nutrition, nutritional losses from the cultivated blackberry. And I'm aware of multiple studies that compare the antioxidant content of wild versus cultivated blackberry. And in every study, the wild blackberry turns up as having a much higher antioxidant content. And in some cases, it is nearly twice the level of antioxidants than the cultivated blackberry. What that means is all of those antioxidants, which are ways that our body deals with free radical damage, which prevents cardiovascular disease and prevents cancer, prevents age-related mental decline, damage to our skin, and all of these kinds of things that are benefits that we get from antioxidant content, the species we buy in the store have significantly less of those compounds that benefit our health. And we could just keep doing this all day long with different species that where we know that testing has been done.
And through all this, I go back to that first example when you're talking about grapes, and my own ignorance is I've always been taught never to eat the seeds. I wouldn't have even thought of them as edible, even though I've seen grapeseed oil for sale.
Right. And then that's because we have really lived in a culture that abhors seeds. And because of that, you and I have been raised with a cultural predisposition against seeded fruit. They're annoying to us. But no one ever tells us that they're actually a source of phytonutrition. There's a great example of this, Scott. We are so used to not wanting seeds in our produce that even when we collect wild things, we will process the seeds out. So one of the really well-known wild species that is a relatively recent comer to our landscape is the autumn olive. And this is not a species of olive, but rather it belongs to its own family. And autumn olive, particularly the one that's here in the Northeast, which is called Eleagris umbellata, it native to Asia, has become a pretty common component of some of our cleared landscapes, roadside, field edges, and those types of places in parts of the Northeast. Now, it has a really wonderful bright red fruit that kind of tastes a little bit like a green apple to me with some other fruit mixed in, but what I'm getting at is absolutely delicious. But what many people like to do with this is make fruit leather. And what they do is they obviously run it through some type of food processor to remove the seeds so they can have this delicious fruit leather that would really remind you of something that you would buy in the store. It's wonderful, and even children enjoy this. But the problem is we got rid of the seed. And the seed in this case happens to be a rich source of not only vitamin E, but omega-3 fatty acids. So we actually got rid of one of the sources that helped balance our high intake of omega-6 fatty acids. But we also eliminated a source of vitamin E from the food which was contained in the seed. And vitamin E, among its many roles in our body, is a fat-soluble antioxidant. So where vitamin C works on the inside of our cells as an antioxidant, protecting our DNA from damage from all kinds of toxic exposures that we have in the modern life, vitamin E protects the cell membrane, the fat-soluble portion, so that these two vitamins work together to keep our cells protected from damage that could potentially lead to cancer. But yet we're removing that part of the food when we process the autumn olive. So it's a really important reason why in this house, it's not that we don't ever make fruit leather without the seeds, but we are sure to consume most of the autumn olives that we collect with the seeds. So we find ways to mix them into things like raw yogurt or into our wild rice hot cereal and things like that so that we're getting those seeds in our diet.
How would someone go about finding out which seeds are edible or inedible?
Well, there are most foraging books. It's written by, you know, authors that understand the fundamental differences in nutrition between wild and cultivated plants will present that information. They will tell you if the seed needs to be removed and if it doesn't. I mean, we have really weird notions about what we can and can't eat sometimes. For example, we're told if we were to eat the wild black cherry or the choke cherry that we need to spit the seed out, that stone on the interior of the fruit. But the indigenous ate them all the time. In fact, they didn't remove them. And so we have to sometimes look to the historical evidence, again, that a competent foraging author will include, to how did the indigenous process these things? Because sometimes, whereas the seed might be mildly toxic, and I want to make clear that toxicity claims of wild plants are highly exaggerated, but where something might be mildly toxic in high quantity raw, simply drying the fruit reduces these potentially toxic compounds in the seeds so that then we can eat the seeds. And in the case of choke cherry, that's all that's required. If you simply dry them, we end up getting another really great source of vitamin E that's found in the seeds of choke cherry. This is how the indigenous consume them. But you don't have to, have to be anthropological nutritionist to figure out what seeds you can eat and what you can't. Because again, foraging books and any good author will be sharing that type of information with the reader.
That leaves us with the last section of those 4 points that you raised for us, though they've all kind of been woven together throughout this conversation.
Yeah. So we're talking just about the vitamins and minerals.
Broadly then, do you want to give us some more information about the nutrition of our wild plants?
What I'll do is provide you some just really good examples as to the differences between our wild and cultivated foods. And there's so many species that we could discuss. And again, students of my classes have heard many of these examples so many times because they just stand as such great examples of what we lack when we have a diet that is filled entirely with cultivated food. So if we were to get started with vitamin A, one of the trick questions that I often ask my students is I ask them, what plants are rich sources of vitamin A? And they start listing off various species like yams and sweet potatoes and carrots, or for leafy greens, we might mention spinach. And then I have to remind them that there isn't a plant on the planet that contains vitamin A. They contain a precursor to vitamin A that we can call provitamin A or carotenoid. And beta-carotene is one of the carotenoids that many people have heard of. But this is not the active form of vitamin A that's found in our body, and it must be converted in our body to the active form, which is, and there are actually several, like retinol and retinal. And that conversion process is not always particularly efficient. In fact, most people only get 1/10 to maybe as much as 1/5 of the vitamin A found in plants at the end of that conversion process. So the whole point of mentioning that is simply to let people know that when we're told plants are rich sources of vitamin A, if that's actually completely false, they're not. They are a source of vitamin A, but they're not necessarily a rich source of it. But fortunately, provitamin A is something that's very good for us because carotenoids work as antioxidants in our body and have other health benefits. And so if we were to look at a leafy source of provitamin A, spinach turns out to be a really good cultivated source. And we don't have to focus on the actual units as much, though I'll mention them. I just want the listeners to pay attention to the numbers. Spinach possesses 8,100 international units of provitamin A per 100 grams of tissue. And that's actually a really good figure. Spinach is one of those plants that has not lost all of its nutrition. But we have many, many, many species that present a higher degree of provitamin A in their foliage. The non-native garlic mustard that is invasive on many of our eastern landscapes presents actually much higher values than that, as high as 19,000 international units. Our native species of violet that flower in the spring of the year have as high as 20,000 units. For example, even the oxeye daisy, now this is a well-known flowering plant that occurs on people's lawns and in the field, its foliage, which is actually quite delicious, has as much as 12,000 units. So a lot of these species that I'm talking about actually possess almost twice to as much as 2.5 times the provitamin A content of really one of the absolutely best exemplar sources from the cultivated plant world. To give you one more example using vitamin C. You know, if I was to ask somebody, tell me what is a good source of vitamin C, and almost everybody says oranges. And in fact, oranges are not that good a source of vitamin C, but we've had a very successful marketing campaign that tells us that they are. And most oranges that are tested contain about 50 milligrams of ascorbic acid per 100 grams of tissue. So we'll just remember that number 50. Well, there are all kinds of wild greens that actually possess more than twice that amount of vitamin C in their tissue. But if we want to sort of compare more apples to apples, in other words, the orange is a fruit, so let's look at other fruits. if we were to compare the vitamin C content of, say, rosehip, something that many people are familiar with, we'll find that they can contain anywhere from 10 to 100 times, and that's not an exaggeration, as much as 100 times the vitamin C content of an orange. What's really important to this whole conversation, though, is the recognition that there have been oranges tested for their vitamin C content, and they were found to have essentially none. And that had to do with how those oranges were raised, how they were stored, how old they were, and some of the processing that they had been through. So really important, oranges really are not that great a source of vitamin C when we look at what is found on our landscape and the numbers that are provided by those crafts.
I'm sitting here doing the math on that. It's just, it's pretty incredible.
Yeah, the thing to remember with all of this, Scott, is that's the level of nutrition that our body is used to receiving. We didn't eat cultivated plants, or even when we started to eat cultivated plants, we still largely had a wild diet that was supplemented by some species of cultivated plant. For example, the indigenous in eastern North America, when they started cultivating the four species of plant that came prior to corn, things like Cunicordium berlandieri, a species of goosefoot, and they also had a gourd that they used for containers and for its edible seeds, a species of sunflower, and a species of marsh elder. These species that they consumed were not a complete crop package for them. In other words, they couldn't just eat these species and nothing else. So they were still eating lots of wild game, still gathering lots of wild plants. And those people, when we examine their health from what we can determine from their skulls and from their skeletons, we can see it was a much greater degree of health than we currently face. Or I should say we currently experience. So remembering that we are used to a much greater level of nutrition than we get now. In fact, estimates put that for fat-soluble vitamins that we're getting only 1/10 of what our indigenous ancestors received, and for water-soluble vitamins, we're receiving only 1/4 of what our indigenous ancestors received. It is no wonder that we run into all of the problems that we experience today. It's also no wonder that cancer, lifetime odds of contracting cancer in this country are 2 in 5. 1 in 2 males, 1 in 3 females. And that is because we simply don't have the nutrition and the phytochemistry that not only powers our immune system, but protects our entire body from all of the sort of the chronic degenerative diseases that end up suppressing our health in this country. And the only way to sort of get that back, it's not through supplementation, because very often we're supplementing with synthetic forms of vitamins, or we might be taking a whole food form of that vitamin if we're seeking those kinds out, but we're not necessarily eating it with all the cofactors that make that vitamin work. It's really important that people realize that vitamins and minerals don't work in vacuum. They need all kinds of other things that we get in our food to make sure they work, including saturated fat. You can supplement with calcium all you want, but we actually need saturated fat along with vitamin D and vitamin K2 and magnesium to make sure that calcium goes to the place it's supposed to go, so it doesn't just deposit in our joints and in our blood vessels. Keeping that in mind, regaining this form of health that people used to have where they lived free of chronic disease, really best made possible through a diet that's rich in not only the best organic and heirloom cultivated foods that we can find or grow ourselves, but also a diet that's rich in wild plants and wild animals if we have access to them.
Well, thank you, Arthur, for walking us through all this. It's a fascinating world, and I think about some of the things that are in my cupboard right now, and will I rebuy some of them once they've been consumed? I wouldn't obviously throw them out because that would be wasteful, but is it something to bring back in?
All life is sacred as far as I'm concerned, and we have to remember that the plants, even the cultivated plants, have essentially given up their lives or part of their growth to feed us, and because of that, it's sort of sacrilege to waste food in this household, because we recognize that life, what was life on that plate, that is now becoming part of our being.
Is there anything else that you would like to add to this conversation for the listeners?
I will leave it with just one last quick item, and that's the medicine that's supposed to be in our food. I would wish that everybody could know that the wild species are profoundly medicinal to our being in both a strict literal sense and in a figurative sense. And all of these medicinal plant compounds that are found in wild species that act as anti-inflammatory, that act as beneficial to our central nervous system, that act against tumors and prevent cancer, that benefit our heart and keep it beating strong and in rhythm, that act against bacteria and fungi that are trying to invade our body constantly. Wild plants are very rich in these medicinal compounds, and we're supposed to receive medicine in that form through our food. And to just keep in mind that that medicine, it's not lost in cultivated foods, but it has been muted through breeding because we didn't seek to ramp up the medicinal content of our cultivated food. We sought to do things like create uniform ripening so that the machine only has to go into the field one time and make it more economical. Or we wanted a fruit that could survive long distance transport across the country. And every time we make modifications to these foods, there are concurrent losses in medicine that our body evolved to be exposed to. And it's very, very easy to recover this. Just eat wild plants.
Thank you, Mr. Haynes, for this conversation and all the places you've taken us. I really appreciate your expertise and knowledge on all this and for taking the time to share it with myself and the audience.
And thanks for having me be part of your program again, Scott.
And that was Arthur Haynes. One of the points Arthur raised in this conversation that stuck with me is from when I was talking with him about the pawpaw, and he said that the work of eating is done for us because of plant breeding and selection. Taking a step back from that, when I look at our supermarkets and current food chain, that space plays a similar role in taking the effort out of eating. We can buy what we want, whenever we want, often prepackaged, prepared, and ready to go for our consumption. I really began thinking about this between the time when I originally recorded the conversation with Arthur several weeks ago and when I finally sat down to edit it for release. And I was reminded over the 2013 holidays when my family fell back on some of our old eating habits. And then in turn, as we're returning to our more thoughtful diet, as we get out from under that crunch, in this transition process, my daughter asked for strawberries. We were able to buy them from the grocery store, where they were imported from California, and came picked, pre-washed, and packaged by the pound, ready for us to pop open and just begin eating. As I was cutting some of them up for my children, I found myself standing there and thinking about the decision that went into purchasing them and how easy it was to buy those berries and bring them home. If I want to, the supermarket allows me to readily do that. Combine that with ready-to-serve foods or heat-and-eat options and restaurants, I never have to prepare or cook food, ever, ever. I can just go buy it ready to go. And I'm not condemning grocery stores or our ability to plug into the worldwide network of food or those who are out in the restaurant industry allowing us to grab and go. But I'm thinking about being more conscious of using those systems, being more aware of our food, where it comes from, what its benefits and deficiencies are for us. I think the place to start that process is to get back into being intimate with our food, and to do that, to start preparing food to eat at home, whatever and wherever we may call home. One meal a week would be a start. We can take it slow, find a favorite recipe from friend or family member and make that part of what we do. Then add another and another until we're comfortable cooking with what we have, what we can buy from the grocery store. If it happens that our recipes call for prepackaged or canned products, and move from there to fresh foods from a farmer's market or ones we grow ourselves, and then add wild foods. Arthur mentioned violets, and they're something that grow here in Pennsylvania and are one of my favorite fresh snacks when they're available and I'm in the yard. Sure, I'm not going to fill up on a handful of them, but they give me something to munch on, as do young dandelion leaves. Both of these are something that you could sneak into a salad and feed to your friends, as new flavors and colors on their plates and for their palates. Then the next time you talk to them and ask about wild foods, you can say, well, you know, you've already eaten some the last time I served you a salad, and have a new conversation about the wonderful edibles all around us. Are you a fan of wild foods? Are you thinking about adding more of them to your diet? Or interested in learning about foraging and how you can supplement what you already do? I'd love to hear from you. Email me, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or give me a call, 717-827-6266. You can also join in the conversation by liking the show on Facebook, facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast, or follow me on Twitter, where I am @permaculturecst. From here, next week on January 14th, Marisha Auerbach joins me to talk about permaculture, biodiversity, and continue some of the threads we've talked about recently about permaculture and education. From there, the first part of my talk with Ramis Kent that begins the series on faith and earth care. We talk about Islam and permaculture. That'll be out on January 21st. And then I will have on Eric Puro of thepush.org to round out the month and set us up for the 4 weeks of February. If you're interested in taking a permaculture design course but haven't had the time or space to do so because of what you do in your everyday life, consider joining me for the next year-long mentored PDC Plus, which begins on April 1st, 2014. Email me for a copy of the course syllabus to see if you're interested, and we can arrange registering you for the class if you'd like. Also, on the website, you'll see two new menu options up there at the top, Show Archives and Release Schedule. The Show Archive is still being filled out, but you'll find the past episodes arranged in chronological order by topic. So, within each topic, the first episode is the oldest on that subject, moving through time until you get to the newest. It's not complete yet, as I am cleaning up the archives as the website continues to develop, and will be adding more links to that list as that process continues, but it's a good place to start. And the release schedule kind of forecasts into the future when different guests, topical episodes, and reviews will come out. That wraps up this episode of the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other. And that little bit of legal. The Permaculture Podcast is released under Creative Commons Attribution, No Derivatives, Non-Commercial License. Feel free to share it with whoever you want. Just let them know where you got it from, and don't change or sell it.